Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Our speaker is Dr. Reuben May, Professor of Sociology at Texas A&M University. Dr. May's lecture is titled, Living Through the Hoop, High School Basketball, Race, and the American Dream. We begin with an introduction by Linda Haywood, Director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University.
Today is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Reuben A. Buford May, who is a professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. He's currently a Martin Luther King Jr. visiting professor in anthropology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and was recently a Sheila Biddle Ford Fellow at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research at Harvard University. Dr. May received his Ph.D. from the University of Chicago in 1996. His recent publications include two books, Talking at Trina's, Everyday Conversation at an African American Tavern, published in 2001, and he was the co-winner of the 2008 Association for Humanist Sociology Book of the Year Award, Living Through the Hoop, High School Basketball, Race, and the American Dream, which was published in 2008. Dr. May is currently working on a book-length manuscript that uses the case of the downtown party scene in Athens, Georgia, to examine how race and culture influence interactional dynamics across categories of space users. His work has also appeared in scholarly journals such as Qualitative Sociology, Qualitative Inquiry, Studies in Symbolic Interaction, Journal of Contemporary Ethnography, and Journal of Ethnic and Racial Studies. In addition to outstanding research, Dr. May is the winner of numerous university undergraduate teaching awards and served on the American Sociological Association contributions to Teaching Excellence Selection Committee in 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006. He also served as the associate editor for Symbolic Interaction, the official journal of the Society for the Study of Symbolic Interaction, 2003-2007, and was guest editor for a special issue on race and symbolic interaction entitled Erasing and Reconstructing Race and the Racialized Self. Dr. May's interests include sociology of sport, race and culture, urban ethnography, and sociology of the everyday. Dr. Mays, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Linda. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. Now, I'm going to talk in three kind of sections. The first section, I'll talk about a problem in general that has motivated me to study young men in high school basketball, and then talk about the project itself. And then finally, the more personal section of the talk will be about my experience with a young man, one particular young man named Calvin Cody. All right. So essentially, Living Through the Hoop is about young African-American men who pursue their dreams or social mobility through athletics. And it focuses on working-class young men in a place called Northeast, which is a pseudonym for a place in Georgia. And it's a metropolitan area about of 160,000, population of 160,000. And so this book looks at that over a seven-year period. But what brought me to this was a broader problem. And that problem was the increasing loss or lack of legitimacy of poor urban black males in broader society. If you look at the statistics, African-American males are disproportionately represented among those who are incarcerated, who have interaction with law enforcement, who are unemployed, and who have poor levels of education. And so the question of legitimacy is about whether these young men can fit into broader society. factors contributing to this problem. So scholars have talked about why do we have these disproportionate representations of African Americans in these particular categories like incarceration, unemployment, et cetera. And William Judas Wilson, who is a professor at Harvard University, talks about discrimination having impact. And Wilson focuses more on historical discrimination, and he argues that because of previous times that there have been it's been an impact that's ongoing with respect to discrimination toward African Americans. Part of what he argued in 1979 in his book called The Decline and Significance of Race, you have to think about that. In 1979, an African American is saying the decline and significance of race. Part of what he argued was that it wasn't contemporary discrimination, but the historical, structural discrimination that created these communities from which people had a difficult time to struggle, and that middle-class African-Americans were in a better position to take advantage of those opportunities being created. Now, contemporary discrimination, Joe Fagan, who is a white professor from, and I mention race because it matters when you're writing, it's a contextual thing. I mention race. He is a white professor at Texas A&M University, and he's written over 40 books. And what he argues is that race continues to have very significant impacts on people's lives, and that not only is there historical discrimination, but contemporary discrimination continues to impact people from these particular communities. And so these are some of the arguments that help to set up the idea that you have low-income African-American communities that have suffered from some discrimination that are highly low-income, and Wilson referred to them as the underclass, and he's since modified that argument. Another contributing factor to the problem is residential segregation. America is a highly segregated place. A city like Chicago has 93% segregation rate, which essentially means that 93% of the African-American population in the city would have to move to another community in order for there to be racial proportional balance. All right? And so this contributes, again, to the fact that young men in these particular contexts see very limited ways to move beyond or gain legitimacy in broader society. And then there's popular culture, which essentially celebrates things like athletics and becoming an entertainer. So the young men's solution, for many of the young men in my study, basketball was seen as a way to move beyond their social condition. They were focused on this idea of living through the hoop or gaining social mobility through athletics. And as I coached the young men, I began to wonder why so many of them believed that basketball could help them move up the social ladder. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense when you see the numbers. Are there 530,000 high school basketball players, but then only 16,000 actually play in college, and then only 450 or 500 or so play professional basketball. So it didn't make a lot of sense, but almost to a complete number, the young men believed that basketball was a way to achieve social mobility. Now, they thought that, and some contemporary individuals also believe that. Sports commentators suggest that sport is a meritocracy where individuals are judged on their performance, and hence it is a especially viable way for one to have social mobility. It is one of those places you can line someone up on end-to-end, tell them to run. They run, and the winner is the better performer. So it is an open and equal opportunity for the young men to perform, whereas in those other contexts, like education and such, there are these other barriers, perceived and real, that the young men face. Now, sociologists have a different take on this. They have two kind of views on this. They say that sport enhances mobility. And what they're talking about is not sport enhancing mobility in the strict sense that one becomes an NBA player. They talk about the byproducts of being participants. So, for example, if you obtain a college scholarship, you get to go and play. You interact with other people who also have these ideas about moving forward. They're networked into possibilities and opportunities for you beyond where you've been before. All right? So sociologists think of it that way. And then there's also the flip side of that that says that sport impedes mobility, when, in fact, part of the argument is that young men or people who participate in athletics focus so much time and energy on it to the exclusion of other activities, it very much limits their abilities and capabilities. Okay? All right. So to give you some sense of the kind of background on studies or books on basketball, which is important to contextualize my book because it's a little bit different than other books. Books in the mainstream that focus on basketball typically are journalists writing these books about a season, right? They follow a team around, gather information, and write about a season. And these seasonal exploits, they normally focus on superstars on those particular teams. Now, how many are familiar with Hoop Dreams? Yeah, good. Fantastic movie. We know that William Gates and Arthur Agee were actually young men who were selected or touched as viable potential superstars from a very young age. And so what these kinds of works tend to do is focus on superstars, people that have potential to go a long way. All right. Now, the scholarly work on basketball, those people who actually study it, there are only two books, well, three currently. One is Backboards and Blackboards by Peter Adler and Patty Adler. And they look at college basketball players. And what they discover is that basketball players have role conflict as student athletes. There's always this constant pressure for them to perform as athletes that it consumes them in such a way that they become poor students. All right, and that was their contribution. And then my book, Living Through the Hoop, which I focus on average athletes. These are young men. When I say average, let me see if I can help you out here. I'm 6'2.5". These guys are 5'6", 5'7", 5'8". They play at a smaller school. They play in less competitive context. These young men represent the vast majority of people who actually compete, and yet they have hoop dreams, which is also very interesting to me. And there's another book out by Scott Brooks. It's new. It's called Black Men Can't Shoot. And essentially what he does is, it's a playoff White Men Can't Jump. And what he does is he follows two young men around as they find a way, they orchestrate their own careers, which is very interesting because we think of basketball players just like we think of entertainers, someone that gets discovered. In fact, what they do is they have a very systematic way of moving from court to court, meeting certain people, trying to make sure that their game is seen. It's a very interesting book. All right, so that's the background for the book, and my project took place over 7 years. I was an assistant coach at Northeast High School. At first, I was a coach for the women's team. My stepdaughter actually played, and she played for 2 years, and I coached for 2 years. And they fired the existing coach, and they hired a new coach. And I remember Coach Benson, the head coach of the boys' team, came to me, and he said, "Look, I hear you guys are getting a new coach over there. I just want you to know, if you don't want to continue there, I have a space for you, an opening for you." My stepdaughter's graduating. I thought, well, that might be a great opportunity. But I figured I would meet with the new coach. And I met with the new coach, and I determined 4 or 5 minutes in that it'd be in the best interest of the players if I just left, right? Too much conflict. And so I joined the Northeast Knights and Coach Benson. Now, Coach Benson he has a master's degree, but the best way to describe him, he's 6'7", and they call him Red because he's a fair-skinned guy, but he has red hair, kind of, sort of. I don't know if I could, you know, give you a best description of it, but red hair, kind of, sort of. And he was from Northeast. Now, right around the high school of Northeast, there are housing projects, 2-block radius around the school. But what's interesting about it is that it's racially mixed. There are more African Americans than whites, but it's still a racially mixed high school. And Coach Benson went to school at Northeast. He left Northeast and went away to a historically black college and university in Atlanta. And then he went on down, I think, to Louisiana for his master's degree, but came back to this community, the Northeast, where Northeast is located. And one of the things that's very interesting about Coach Benson is he grew up in the projects. So he's well aware of the kinds of struggles the young men meet with as they move around that community. Now, how many people have ever gone out for an athletic team? Just let me see a show of hands. Good. So we've all had. Yeah, they went out for it. Well, Coach Benson practices a no-cut policy, right? So most teams average 15 players, 12 to 15 players. Coach Benson lets anyone who wants to play try out for the team and stay with the team as long as they participate. Now, you might say, well, how do things sift out? That means that 1 year we had 28 players on the varsity and 22 uniforms, right? So every game we had to decide on who got to wear a uniform. And it was very crushing to me because he would always wait till an hour before the game and he'd come to me and say, okay, May, this is who's playing. And I'd have to go and pass the uniforms out. And the guy would go, May, where's my uniform? You have to ask the man, you didn't get one this week. But it was very crushing. But the reason why he had a no-cut policy is because he understood that these young men were in very difficult situations. In fact, over his 14-year career, he had lost four players to violence. Two had been stabbed, and then two had been shot to death. And only one was actually on the team. These other guys had been hurt after they had graduated and left the team. And this one guy that was on the team, he actually was riding in the backseat of a car. And the car apparently looked like someone that had killed or shot at this other guy. And the guy walks up to the car, shoots him, kills him. Next day he comes in and he turns himself in. A simple case of mistaken identity. Young man shot. Simply. So Coach Benson is fully aware of the situation he's dealing with, and that's why he has his no-cut policy. And also, he loved to use profane language. And this was difficult for me because I was trying to reform myself. And so you would say to the players, all right, guys, I don't want to use profanity. Throw the ball. Right? Throw the ball. Just throw it at the floor. And they would not throw the ball. Right? Throw the damn ball. Ball gone. So I had to kind of give in a little bit on that, trying to be reformed, because Coach Benson, that was just part of his personality. And so he fit in very much with the community. All right. So in addition to the participant observation, which is basically taking notes about everything that goes on, even in the summertime when we had workouts with the young men, I also conducted 18 exit interviews. And this is really interesting because I was actually surprised that in talking to the young men as they were graduating, they still had aspirations to play. 5'6", 5'7", thinking I'm going to play in college. This is really amazing to me. But the other thing that I really found out about these interviews is that it was also a time, in the interview I give the players a chance to tell me something you think, or tell me what you think, any ideas or anything you have on your mind. They would instantly begin to critique in a very honest manner choices and decisions that coaches had made, which meant to me that the interviews were really kind of honest revealings of how they were thinking about the world. And so I asked them questions about family, drug use, sexual habits, all kinds of things. And that stuff is detailed in the book itself. But the exit interviews gave me a good sense of the young men and their perspectives on their lives with respect to aspirations. Now, Northeast High School is 55% black, 35% white, 7% Hispanic, 2% Asian, 1% multiracial, 51% dropout rate. Now, you might go, wow. That means that of the freshman class, 51% of those people would drop out before they graduated, right? In the state of Georgia, the whole state of Georgia, average 53%. That's amazing to me that we could have, 100 ninth graders and 49 only graduate. That's amazing. So that was characteristic of the school. All right. And the Knights players, as I said before, there were 28 players on a team. We averaged 20, 21 players on a team each year. Most of them were from the housing projects from right around the school. Most of them were average height, average skill, and average ability. And you'll see how that plays out a little bit later. Most of them had great admiration for Coach Benson. Oh, I should also note that Coach Benson coached four of his nephews. right? The last one of which was Calvin Cody. So you see how it's a small kind of network, people from the community, from the neighborhood. In contrast to where they grow up and play, they play in Wilmington County. Wilmington County is a predominantly white county, right, in Georgia. So you have 12 teams in a region, Northeast Knights being one that's predominantly African-American. They would travel to these schools in Wilmington County. In Wilmington County, what you need to know about Wilmington County is that people who are white were moving from Atlanta as part of white flight out into Wilmington County to get away from blacks. Give you some context. So what would happen when we go to play in Wilmington County, we wouldn't get any calls, right? There'd be cheap shots. And then you have problems with the fans. For instance, you come out to the court and the fans will say, oh, look at those. Look, it's the little black monkeys. Hmm. Or one referee had to stop a game because the fans were chanting. Now, this is 2003, right? So just a little, you know, explicit kinds of tension that they had to deal with. Not only that, but Wilmington County was a relatively wealthy county. So you have across the street from their high schools, $300,000, $400,000 homes. Okay? All right. Now, what I discovered, I discovered that there's a tight-knit relationship between four factors that support what I call the dirty trick. And that dirty trick is the belief that basketball is a viable way to climb the social ladder. Those four factors are, one, mass media, community influence, self-conceptions of athletic ability and competitive context, and coaches' influence. And I'm going to talk about each one of these, break it down. Mass media. Mass media depiction of professional athletes and conspicuous consumption gave the young men a sense that that's what they wanted to do. They would see Shaquille O'Neal in his big body SUV with 17 speakers blaring down the road, and they'd say, I want to be like Shaq, right? That was the idea. They see the athletes, if they see something they want, they buy it, right? And so the young men were able to connect to this idea that if you played athletics or compete in athletics, you could actually have or earn money to do conspicuous consumption. And conspicuous consumption is a problem more broadly in America. How do we keep it? We're branding everything. We're wearing things with brands and such. And so this is consistent with how they might interpret those, the mass media. Mass media presentation of the professional athlete as achieving the American dream by surviving rough neighborhoods conditions gave the young men also a sense that the people they were watching were like them. So, for instance, who do you think was, given the neighborhood I described, who do you think might have been an athlete that they related to? Boom, right on the head. Allen Iverson, caught smoking marijuana, fighting in the Virginia nightclub, taking his wife, terroristic threats, you know, all kinds of juice. Although he was acquitted on all of those, some of those charges didn't even go through, the young men really identified with him because guess what? He was still tough. He was from a place like they were from, and he played basketball, and he was small. He was capable of doing it. And so they really related to him. And this, so they had this sense and idea that you could still be who you were and achieve the American dream. All right? All right. Now, the community influence. Now, residents of poor Northeast communities perceive limited opportunities all around them. So when you talk to the people in the community, they understood completely that these young men didn't have a lot of opportunity within the community. They couldn't see the distance as something, you know, beyond their particular community for being successful. And residents see that schools do not normally produce prominent people from their community except for athletes, right? So in their community, you don't hear about great doctors, great lawyers, great scientists. You hear about athletes. And in fact, there was one, and I think I'll talk about him a little bit later, who had some success and just had recently graduated and went on to college, finished college, and ended in the NFL. Okay, NFL. So these are the things they see, all right? And in general, respect in these particular communities is given more to athletes and entertainers. And one of the things I also found interesting is that at the local level, the young men would see, go get the newspaper. Right, because they covered sports and athletics. You see a big color picture of a high school kid on the back of the newspaper. But nowhere near do you see academic All-Americans, academic anything, right? It was all about athletics. And so in the particular community, these things supported this notion of achieving through athletics. All right, self-conceptions of athletic ability in competitive context. Players experience success in a competitive realm that is average. So here they are competing in a realm with 12 teams of average players like themselves, right? And what happens when you average people play average people? You have some success, right? So you kind of miscalculate what your ability is based on the context in which you play. Right? So they play with average people. And they lacked the knowledge of elite competition beyond their own region. So they didn't know anything about AAU teams, which select for guys that are 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", and can do the same things that these little guys could do, right? They believed, hey, you know, I'm competitive like those guys are. No understanding of that. And then finally, players see themselves mimicking professional athletes' moves and thus equate their own ability to that of their favorite players, which is really interesting. We were in a tape session. This guy named Harry, about 6 feet tall. Tape session. Now, in tape session, coaches are supposed to say, all right, let's correct these errors that we make here. Rewind the tape, short over. This kid says in the middle of the session, all right, look at Allen Iverson. Look, watch this crossover. Got him, score. You know, he's cheering himself on, right? So that same kid, Harry, got him in an exit interview. I say, Harry, is there anything that Iverson can do that you can't do? Oh, I can do everything. I can shoot like him. I can dribble like him. I can dunk like him. I can do everything. No, not really, Harry. This is a smaller realm. But so they see themselves performing, and they think, I can replicate that. Okay. All right, now coaches' influence. And this is the part where I had the greatest amount of tension. Because I know, as a sociologist, the very slim chances, but we continued to feed them the dirty tricks, so to speak. And it's important because coaches feed players a dream because it is better for team success. If everyone on the team is striving to go to the next level, they're improving the overall team competitive context, and so it makes the team better. And so coaches had a real purpose in saying, kid, you know, work hard. Work hard, work hard. But the coaches also saw the danger the young men were exposed to and knowingly perpetuated the dirty trick. I remember when I first started, there was this kid in the gym with Coach Benson, and he kept saying, Coach, what do I have to do to make it to the next level? And Coach would say, well, look, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, and you can make it. And I'm saying in my head, no, he can't. This kid is frail. He doesn't have the ability. But slowly, I became aware of what they were dealing with and knew that he was only trying to give them hope in that particular context. So when I started doing it, I started saying stuff like, well, in order to play at the next level, you have to have a jump shot. So you need to work on your jump shot. Just encouragement, because the kid really wanted just to be encouraged in something. Okay? All right. Now, are these athletic aspirations that the young men had, based on those four factors, kind of contributing to their choice of this, are they good or bad for them? And I would say these aspirations are good because the young men can hope and dream. As I said before, if you're in a context where you don't have opportunity or you don't see other opportunities, then it's important to have hope and dreams. Someone ran a whole campaign on hope, right? You know, all right, hope and dreams, right? These aspirations are bad because the young men develop unreal expectations and cannot achieve that dream, right? So how do you, Professor May, rectify or reconcile this tension between the two? And where I come down is that in the end, I believe that these aspirations are good because they prolong the lives of these young men given their immediate context, okay? All right. Now, what you also have to remember, too, we're talking about high school players. So by the time they've reached us, they've been failed in many other instances with respect to education, et cetera. And so we're trying to figure out a way to keep them in school, get them out of high school and on to the next place, wherever that is, so someone else can pick them up and move them to the next place. It's a weird way to think about it, but makes rational sense to me. All right, conclusions. All right. The young man's aspirations parallel the long shot dreams that other individuals have in other contexts. Now, it's important to think about this. These young men should not be derided in any way for having these hoop dreams. Because as we sit here, I'm sure, even in college now, some of you all have dreams that may be long shot. I don't know what they are, but they may be long. This is consistent with the kinds of aspirations that people have in general. And sometimes our parents are the worst, feeders of the dirty trick, right? Give you an example. If you go to any kindergarten, you'll have a classroom full of students, and some kid will inevitably say, I want to be president of the United States, right? Now, if you take race out of it, because Obama would be the exception, but if you take race out of it, the average person is not going to become president. That is a long shot dream, right? And yet the teachers say, great, Johnny, you could be president. Right? No, Johnny, you're dumb. You know, you can't be president. But great, Johnny, you can be president. So we kind of encourage these kind of long shot dreams. If you think about a parent will get a kid an instrument and the kid will play an instrument. Good job. Good job. No, it's not. Right? We discover early on that they don't have talent, but we encourage anyway, because that is the responsibility of parents to encourage. So we shouldn't deride these young men for having these aspirations that go beyond their capabilities. All right? Now, failure may be impending, but we have a social system that encourages the modification of aspirations. So what we learn how to do is, if we shoot high, right, and then as we fail, we modify what it is that we do. So from I want to be president to I want to be congressman to I want to be on the city council to I want to be a leader in the community to, you know, whatever it is. So someone might say, I want to be rich. Right. And then, you know, then you might get married and have a kid and say, well, I just need to go to work. And so you modify your aspirations. And our system works like that. It helps us to modify aspirations. And then finally, ultimately, I believe that the best one can do is to understand the limitations of our system and play the game to its fullest. So to be clear that it's a long shot that you might not make it, give the best effort you can, and then from there, learn or work to deal with your situation. So have some full sense that there are limitations to this. All right, so now the more personal part of living through the hoop. As an ethnographer, you spend a lot of time with your subjects. And for me, they were not subjects first, but they were players first and then became subjects. One gets close to players, and one of the players I got really close to was Calvin Cody. And Calvin Cody grew up in East Ridge. He was the nephew of Coach Benson. His mother was a crack addict. His father was an alcoholic that walked the street, and Calvin didn't know who his father was until one day his aunt, Coach Benson's sister, said, do you know who that is right there? Got a drunk guy standing on the corner. And he said, no. He said, that's my dad, your daddy. And that's disturbing to discover that. He lived in a 1-2-3-room house with his grandmother and older brother, and his older brother was a drug dealer, right? So Calvin Cody's got a great life lined up, right? And Calvin loved basketball, and he played basketball. And he was one of those players that was really a wonderful kid. You ask him to do something, he would do it. You could tell him, run to that wall and run through the wall, and he'd try to do it. And he was somebody I came really attached to, and I'm going to share with you about Calvin Cody from the book, because it's, you know, a really moving part for me to talk about that. And this is from the epilogue. And he's one of these young men that raised the question for me, is it right to give the dirty trick? Right? is the right to perpetuate the dirty trick. It was February 8th, 2006, at about 7:30 p.m., and I just finished playing basketball at Texas A&M University's Student Recreation Center. I was sitting in my car with the engine running. I removed my cell phone from my bag and placed it in my lap. As I pulled out of the parking lot onto the street, I noticed that I had a text message. I flipped open my cell phone to find a message from Shaka, one of my former Northeast high school players. Shaka had graduated from Northeast in 1999, gone on to college, and was now in his second year of law school. We had kept in touch with each other over the years, but several months had passed since I had last talked to him. As I held the car on the road, I managed to read the following text message. "Did you hear what happened to Calvin Cody?" I wasn't sure what to think about the message. I steadied my car and typed my reply to Shaka. "No." Yeah, we shouldn't be texting while driving. Okay. I don't do this anymore, okay? "No. What happened?" As I waited for Shaka's response, I began to recall how Calvin had survived his adolescent years in East Ridge, graduated from high school, and went on to play basketball at a small college in Georgia. The last time I had seen Calvin was during his winter break from school when he came to visit to the high school. On his visit, we laughed and joked, and he told me how excited he was to be playing college basketball. I could still hear his enthusiastic shout of, "Maydog." That's what the team used to call me. My thoughts then slipped further back to his high school career. I thought about what a great kid Calvin had been for me to coach. Calvin was the kind of young man to whom special things should happen. He worked hard, developed his skills through individual practice, did whatever coaches asked him to do, and generally was generally pleasant to all those with whom he came into contact. He was well-liked by players, coaches, teachers, and people from the community. My recollections of Calvin were interrupted when my phone vibrated. I flipped open my phone and read Shaka's reply. "Calvin shot and killed himself." I partially bowed my head and shook it from side to side. I couldn't believe it. How could someone who had survived the temptation of drugs and the neighborhood violence of East Ridge choose to take his own life? I took a deep breath and replied to Shaka, "What happened?" Even as I typed the message, I couldn't believe that I was asking this question about Calvin Cody. For me, Calvin represented all that was good about Coach Benson's efforts and the Northeast Knights. Calvin had succeeded because he was determined, and basketball provided the social space in which he could succeed. He had been saved, so to speak, by his involvement in basketball. But had he really survived? I began to wonder if somehow Calvin's family history had caught up to him in the form of foul play. Did someone shoot him and make it look like suicide? Did he, after years of avoiding the drugs and violence, decide that he should get involved? Something wasn't right. There had to be some other explanation for his death, because Calvin was too good a kid, too happy, too motivated to commit suicide. Shaka replied back, "I'm in class right now. Call Mr. Hunt. He can tell you." "Thanks for letting me know," I text back. He said, "I had to. I knew you coached him." I called Sammy Hunt, the team statistician, but was instantly forwarded to Hunt's message box. I left a message. "Hey, Hunt, I've heard some disturbing news about Calvin, and I want to know if it's true or not. Please call me back when you get this message. May." As I ended the call, an eerie feeling came over me while I navigated the dark highway road. I began to accept that Calvin Cody indeed was gone. In a fit of mixed emotions, anger, frustration, sadness, I banged the steering wheel of my car several times with my open hand. "Fuck," I yelled. With each successive strike to the steering wheel, I let go of the confused mix of emotions. I began to think, why this kid? Why that way? I had many questions that could not be answered. I frantically called other coaches from the Northeast coaching staff, but no one answered their phones. This was a sure sign that Calvin Cody was gone. Later that evening, Hunt returned my call. Hunt had been Calvin's mentor from middle school through high school. "Hey, Reuben, I got your message," he said. "So, Hunt, is it true? Is it true what happened?" I asked. "Calvin shot himself yesterday," he said stoically. Despite his calm tone, I knew Hunt was hurting. He and Calvin had developed a close bond, spending many hours together getting Calvin's schoolwork done, traveling to and from basketball practice and games, and sharing the pains and joys of life. During my interview with Calvin after his senior year of basketball, Calvin told me how important Hunt had been to helping him get through school. "Are you all right?" I asked Hunt. "Yes," he replied. "I'm okay right now. This morning I couldn't make it to work. I got up and started on my way, but when I got to the school and entered the building, it hit me. My principal saw me and told me to go home. I was a mess this morning, but I'm doing a little better now." "Well, what happened?" I asked cautiously. Hunt took a deep breath and began. "Last night we had our playoff game against Norton. We won the game and qualified for the state playoffs. As we got back to the school, I dropped the kids off and went by my classroom to do some work for about 20 minutes. On my way back home, I got a call from Ken Rowe. It's a 20-year-old cousin of Calvin. Ken told me that Calvin had shot himself and told me to go over to the hospital. When I got to the hospital, Benson was in a turnaround leaving with Calvin's father in the car. Benson stuck his hand out the window as I approached his car and then put his hand to his face and started crying. He's gone." "Damn," I said. "Hunt, why? Why did he do it?" "Well, you know, Calvin had been complaining about pain in his chest. So on Tuesday, he was on the phone talking to his friend Terrence, and Terrence said that Calvin was on the phone complaining about the pain in his chest. Calvin's girlfriend had just left him, too, so I think he was depressed about that. And he hadn't made it back to school for whatever reason. But he was on the phone with Terrence, and Terrence said something to him, but Calvin didn't answer. Then all of a sudden, Terrence heard a single gunshot. He hung up the phone and drove over to Calvin's apartment. He found Calvin on the ground with a single shot in his heart. Calvin was still alive, so Terrence called an ambulance. They got him to the hospital, but couldn't save him." "Are we sure there wasn't any foul play?" I asked. "As they do all cases, the police are investigating his death," said Hunt. "But he was in a lot of pain. The doctors had told him that he would have to have corrective surgery for his heart." Apparently, Calvin was experiencing pain from a heart ailment that he had as a young man. In all the time that I had coached Calvin, that's 5 years, I had never known him to complain about pain in his chest. Perhaps he was in pain when he played and just didn't say anything. Calvin was the kind of kid that wouldn't complain. "I just don't understand," I said to Hunt. "I didn't even know he had a gun," Hunt replied. "The last time I saw him, he was doing all right." "When is the funeral?" I asked. "They don't know yet." "Well, please let me know. I'm going to do whatever I can to make it." "Take care," Hunt said. "You too." So I drive or fly to Northeast from Texas. And Calvin Cody thought about this a lot, you know. Here it is in my mind that this young man played basketball all this time. And when they told him he had a heart ailment, maybe he thought he couldn't play anymore, and that was the end of his world. And it raised an issue. How can you, Reuben, justify feeding him this dirty trick, right? He put so much in this thing that he can't have anymore. And so he thinks life is desperate, and he takes his life. How could you do that? Well, my wife, I shared that with my wife, and let me just read two more paragraphs. After I'd gone, went to the funeral, Coach Benson asked me to coach on the bench with the team. It was just like I hadn't been gone. I was gone 8 months, just like I hadn't been gone. It was a double overtime defeat. It was supposed to be one of the greatest games played in the area. And it was really, really an emotional experience. So I'm headed back home. On my flight home, I contemplated whether the other coaches and I had done all we could have done for Calvin. We had encouraged him to play basketball. We had given him a place to be someone through athletics in middle school and high school. I suspect, however, that it was Calvin's investment in basketball and ultimately the prospect that he could no longer compete because of his heart problems that drove him to take his own life. I was left wondering if we had, as coaches, helped him escape to a better place. Had our dirty trick worked? When I shared my thoughts with my wife, she said, "You know, you all might have been the only reason that Calvin lasted as long as he did." In my grief, I hadn't looked at it that way. I reflected on my wife's words and thought about Calvin's interview with me some 3 years earlier. It was then that I realized that he told me that playing basketball had helped him stay out of trouble. It was then that I realized that indeed we had given Calvin Cody a chance. In the end, that is all we could do. My experience with the Northeast Knights has taught me that basketball offers young black men like Calvin, who see so clearly the reality that their opportunities are constrained by their race and by where they live, go to school, and grow up, a chance to hope for better in spite of their dismal starting point. These young men should no more be derided than any of us who invest our lives in long shot dreams. After all, such dreams are conceived in a society that says to all, you all can achieve whatever you want if you work for it. The sad reality is that young black men continue to be disproportionately blocked from achieving alternatives to hoop dreams. And that concludes the talk. Thank you.
How intense was community support for the team, and did the players themselves take on a celebrity status within the projects?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. 110%. So there's a chapter 3 in here, drinking, drugs, and delinquency. And they took on such great status that thugs, drug dealers, they would say, go away from here. You have potential. You got something going, right? Community people would pat them on the back. Right. Or they would get a hamburger meal or something because of how they played or whatever. So people really embrace that. So it further perpetuated this idea that if you pursue athletics, there's good things to come out of it. I remember Coach Benson once. OK, two short stories. Try to make them short. Coach Benson once he brought the young men together and said, look, when you're winning, people are going to give you things that you never had before, things you have never seen. OK. So when I detail this in the book, so we go to a game, right? He says that at the morning meeting on Saturday. We get in a bus, ride 45, 50 minutes, go to the game, and we win. And now it's dark out. We go to McDonald's. We order the food, and we have it. And these three young ladies come in to McDonald's, right? I'm going to leave the scripters off, but they come into McDonald's. And one of our players starts talking to them. And we had to get on the bus, and we jumped on the bus. So we get on the bus, 45 minutes now, one direction. These young ladies start following us back to the campus, and we're trying to figure out what did he say, right? But we had won the game. So we ride along, and the girls pull up alongside of the car, and they let the window down, and they just have their bras on, right? Okay. Let the window back up, and they get back behind us. A few minutes later, they pull back up to us. This time, no bra. Coach Benson tells the bus driver, cut the light on. They cut the light on and say, hey, sit down. This is what you get when you win. But they were very much respected in the community, and Coach Benson took the time to emphasize that. He would say in the locker room, you represent Northeast. You're not just representing yourself. You're representing Northeast. Don't make your parents look bad, right? Don't make your family look bad. You're representing these. And the kids actually bought into that. And it was important because this was a small team. Yeah, 1 year we had guys that were, I'm the 6'2", no one taller than 6'1", playing on a team. And we would beat teams, right? He was a motivator, great motivator, press all game, little guy, you would just get after it. But that's what that was part of his manipulation was that. And the community supported that because they love success.
Now, early on, you mentioned that the setting of the basketball team was in, what was it called, Wilmington
Heights? Yeah, well, Wilmington County is where they play, yes.
And it was a predominantly well-off area.
Right.
Did traveling in that area and playing with those other teams, did they confront any reality that some of these other teams might be just a little bit better because of the resources that they had and kind of shot down their dream, your individual students?
No. In fact, there were better players, but see, the collective will of the Northeast Knights, very successful. Very successful. So we could see better players and still have success. So that nullified the superiority of that athlete. In fact, you would have players on other teams. One guy was 6'10" and played AAU basketball and was being recruited by top schools in the Southeast, right? But on his home team against little bitty Knights who were about taking care of business, they lost. So that nullifies, again, you know, the team collective chemistry worked against, you know, the other team and provided fuel for this idea that they could be successful. Because you hear stuff like this. Oh, man, he ain't 6'10". He ain't number 15 player in the state. Right? Look what we did. See, false understanding about the context. So the success of the team kind of worked against the young men understanding that as well. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Texas A&M professor Dr. Reuben May titled Living Through the Hoop, High School Basketball, Race, and the American Dream. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Our speaker was introduced by Linda Hayward, Director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Mark Liambruni. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Leitoes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.